Okay, good evening all. So let's get started, dive right into things here. Really two topics, one from Parshas Bishalach and one from Parshas Yisro this evening. And I was just mentioning, I think that they are rather interrelated in something of a philosophical, even Musar kind of context. Not like, you know, shaking the finger Musar, but Musar in terms of self-development and self-reflection and thinking about our midos, our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and others, and all that kind of good stuff. So let's get started. The first topic that I wanted to address, let me grab an actual chumash here, is one that I've actually given a couple of shiurim on before. It's really the same shiur that I think I delivered twice with a couple of different variations from the first round to the second round, but some new material that I came across that I think is very interesting, and having nothing to do with the way that I even presented it the first time around, should you have heard that, just a really, really compelling kind of topic. I will give the same intro that I've given when I've spoken about this previously, which is that I remember listening to a Mets game on the radio. I remember Howie Rose was calling the game. And at some point, out of nowhere, it was like a totally innocuous, boring, completely benign sort of the game, part of the game. And I mean, just this is what happens when you're a Mets fan. You grow to assume that games don't generally matter in the first place, for most seasons anyway. And just out of absolutely nowhere, everybody starts cheering. And you're used to hearing like the crack of the bat and then, you know, the thunderous crowd in the background. And out of absolutely nowhere, everybody starts cheering. So Haru Rose, the announcer, says, "Let me explain to you what's going on, because you probably hear all of the fans cheering." And he says that across the scoreboard, what just flashed is that the U.S. Armed Forces have just captured Osama bin Laden. And everybody starts cheering. And I don't remember how old, I don't remember when this all happened. For whatever reason, I don't know that it necessarily, that all of this material in terms of, I guess, Jewish philosophy and Jewish hashkafa necessarily resonated. But there was something that gave me pause about that whole sort of scenario, about the idea of cheering and howling and hooting at effectively the downfall of our enemies, and the degree to which that is appropriate, and the degree to which that's not appropriate. And it's not my point here to question anybody's response when those kinds of things have already happened, but sort of philosophically what our approach should be when we find these kinds of things. And I think largely, for the most part, we think very much of being in support of that. We think about Purim and celebrating the downfall of our enemies, and we think at least to some degree about Pesach. We'll see some other material that runs contrary to that and militates against that. But for the most part, with regards to Pesach, we celebrate the downfall of our enemies, at least largely, overwhelmingly. That's sort of the joke. They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. Jewish holiday in a nutshell. So the first, and really one of the core sources for this whole topic, in terms of suggesting that we really should not engage in that kind of behavior, that even when our enemy, our sworn enemy, somebody who is just viewed as being evil incarnate, goes down, that we shouldn't necessarily be so quick to rejoice. A core source for that whole concept is the Gemara in Megillah. The Gemara in Megillah on Daf Yud Amud Beis starts as follows. And I put that little arrow there just to point really to the first line, but let's start at the end of that line at any rate. Umni chadi HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'mefaltan shel rasha'im. Does Hashem rejoice? Does Hashem become happy? Does Hashem become glad over the downfall of the wicked? V'haksiv, but the pasuk says, this is a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, b'tzeis levnei chalutz v'omrim hodu l'Hashem ki le'olam chasdo. The idea is that as the soldiers march out to war, that there was going to be, this was in the days of Yehoshaphat, that as the soldiers march out to war and they are leading to, or marching towards certain victory, so there will be this band who goes out before the soldiers or along with the front lines that give this praise to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hodu l'Hashem ki le'olam chasdo. So that sounds like a refrain that we're probably pretty familiar with, save a couple of words. Hodu l'Hashem ki tov ki le'olam chasdo. So ki tov is noticeably absent from this line. What happened? V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan questioned that. What's going on? That's a standard refrain all throughout Judaism. That whenever we praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hodu l'Hashem ki tov ki le'olam chasdo, Give thanks to Hashem, for he is good, and his kindness endures forever. Where'd the kitov, where'd the it's good, or because he's good, where'd that go? Why is it that they didn't say kitov during this particular Thanksgiving? You know why? Because Hashem doesn't rejoice over the downfall of the wicked. So because it's true, the Jewish people, the Jewish all soldiers are going out to war, and there's this sense of triumph, of spirit, of military might, and down go the enemies, and down go the wicked, and all those who stand against Am Yisrael and against the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and certainly at the time, all of these pagans and backward, wayward barbarians, all true. But at the end of the day, even though they might be Rishon, these are HaKadosh Baruch Hu's creatures. And there is something of a tear shed over that reality. So we can't rejoice and we can't proclaim that Kitov, that Hashem thinks it's so good, that this is an expression of his goodness, because there is this disaster and there is this loss of life that happens in the course of the downfall of the enemies. Our victory, the flip side of our victory, is the downside and the loss of life of our enemies.
It's like on Yom Kippur where we blow 100, but not 101, because even the mother should have sin.
Because of Sisera and Sisera's mother. Look, you find it also, and the reason why this comes up here is because of this next pasuk, which we find here on the banks of Kriyas Yamsuf, on the banks of the Yamsuf at Kriyas Yamsuf, which is why this is a Bishalach-related issue. But I mean, we know ourselves. What do we do famously when we tick off all of the makos, the incredible makos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? It's Yad Hashem, and it's all of Hashem's nisim and niflaos, and all the miraculous things that are taking place in Mitzrayim. What do we do as we remember those? We spill out a little bit of wine from the glass, because it's this mealy-mouthed expression of gladness, of simcha. I wish it didn't have to be so. These were people who oppressed us. These were wicked, evil people. And we felt the brunt of just how wicked and evil and backwards they were. And yet, it's with something of a heavy heart that we rejoice as we know that they went down. So there's this very human and this obsession with humanity, even when it comes to our own enemies. And we see that it doesn't just come from us. Apparently, it's HaKadosh Baruch who gives this directive. And here we go. Ma'idichsiv. What does the pasuk mean when it says, V'lo karav zeh el zeh kol halayla? Now backtrack. In the context of our parasha, anybody know what this refers to? Right, and one didn't approach the other, one didn't come close to the other the entire night. This is talking about Kriyas Yamsuf. And at least Pshuto Shel Mikra, on the most basic level, what this is talking about is Klal Yisrael and the Egyptians. Because the Amud HaEsh sort of retreated to behind the Jews and stood between the Mitzrayim and Klal Yisrael, Lo Karam Zel Zeh Kol HaLayla, they weren't able to come towards one another, try as they might, try as the Egyptians might, they couldn't actually overtake the Jews because there was this barrier of fire that existed between themselves and the Jewish objective. So, what happens is they try, but they can't. Now, the way that the Gemara understands this is that at this same time, and this is like Midrashic, this is how Midrash often works in the first place, that the way Chazal understand this is that it's not just a reference, it's like a superimposing, there are multiple narratives going on here that are all layered upon the same pasuk, or all made reference to within the same pasuk. It's not just the Jews and the Egyptians, but typically when we think about what happens kol halayla, is that the malachei hasharis, all the angels line up in order to give praise to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in order to sing the songs to Hashem. And that's what's going on all night long. And yet on this night, V'lo karav zeh el zeh kol halayla, the malachim couldn't come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as they usually do, as they wanted to. They wanted to sing Shira, and especially tonight, because now it finally happens. You promised all of those generations ago that you were going to free the children of Avraham, and now it's finally happening. And the Egyptians are getting their comeuppance, and anybody who stands against your people stands against you, and they're going to bear the full brunt of your might. So this is Jewish victory. That night especially, they wanted to sing Shira. So Rabbi Elazar explains what happened. Amar Rabbi Elazar, who Bikshu Malachi Asharis Lomar Shira. So what happened was the Malachi Asharis wanted to sing Shira, as they usually do, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And instead, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ma'aseh Yadai Tovin Bayam, famous words, my maaseyot, my handiwork, my creations, the Egyptians, are sinking. They are drowning in the yam. V'atem omrim shira? Are you going to stand here and sing shira? Like, you know, I have any idea how hard this is for me to actually witness, to actually, to see this unfolding before my very eyes? So Rabbi Elazar had something of an answer. Now, what happens at the beginning of this Gemara, when we initially asked, is this true that HaKadosh Baruch Hu rejoices over the downfall of our enemies? The issue is that there are psukim that seem to suggest that, yes, that's so. And there are actually psukim, there's a Gemara at the beginning of Brachos that we'll see at least referenced, that makes that point also. The point is that it doesn't seem to be totally clear. Does he or does he, do we or don't we? What is our response supposed to be when this kind of thing happens? How do you respond when you finally get word that the camps have been liberated? It's this sense of exaltation, of freedom, but is there also a certain degree of happiness and rejoicing over the fact that our enemies finally got what was coming to them? So that's the whole question. Rabbi Elazar tries to hedge what's going on here. Who enosas avalachei remesis? That he himself, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, doesn't rejoice, but he does allow others to. Now, how that squares away with the malachim in this case, his point was that the malachim can't try to bring Shira to him because he's sort of crestfallen, kivyachol. But that might give license to others to rejoice at this time. What's going on while Hashem is all crestfallen? What are the Jews up to at this particular moment? What's going on? What are they doing while all this is taking place? While Hashem is having this conversation up with all the angelic beings upstairs, what do the Jews do as they cross Kriyas Yam Suf? As they cross the Yam Suf? They're singing Shira. As Yeshua, we say it every day. And when we lane it, we do it with this even more melodious tune than we usually do for regular laning. So there's this. So it's a very interesting approach from Rabbi Elazar that on the one hand there might be license to the Jewish people to be able to do so, but recognize at the same time that HaKadosh Baruch Hu he's crestfallen, he's dejected, he is less than thrilled with the fact that this is how it had to happen. Yeah, sure.
Is there any kind of language like this by Noah? Where Hashem now, you know, says, right, the rest, I'm only saving Noah and whatever. He still destroyed his people for not being good.
Right, right.
But I don't.
So it's interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting question. You don't find, at least, that there is this suggestion of specific Shira, or this desire for Shira, specifically at the time of Noah,
right.
Which maybe is interesting in of itself, that there was something uniquely special, and that's something that it's like a whole shiur unto itself,
right.
But there's something uniquely special not only about those who stand against Hashem's sense of decency finally getting what's coming to them, but there's also something uniquely special about Klal Yisrael specifically fulfilling its destiny and making good on the bris, and Hashem making good on his bris that we had enacted with one another. So it's a very, very interesting point, but this seems to be something of a sort of a unique phenomenon, at least with respect to the Jewish people as opposed to the rest of humanity. So it's a little bit inconclusive, I guess, right? On the one hand, we say that maybe there's some license to human beings to rejoice, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself doesn't. A little bit tricky. On the other hand, what we are left with clearly is this sense that Hashem is not, it's not like all wine and roses up in Shemayim when these kinds of things happen. We have to remember just how difficult it is for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to live through, as it were, these moments in which there's this tremendous amount of disappointment. Like what he would have hoped for, not just from the Jewish people, right? We're always on center stage, but we have to remember that we're not the only participants and the only actors in human history and in human destiny. And there is this desire, this pining, that the rest of humanity is also going to be able to come out on top. And it's just so demoralizing, it's so deflating to Hashem when it doesn't work out the way. And that's something to at least keep in mind. And a couple of very, very interesting sources that really drive that home and drive home this, I guess, something of a dichotomy when it comes to the manner in which we're supposed to react. When do we rejoice? When don't we rejoice? What do we rejoice over? What do we need to be very, very clear that we don't rejoice over? How does that affect our attitude? How does that affect our perspective of history, of Jewish history, and everything else that we might witness going on around us and whatever might hit the front page of the newspaper? So a very, very important source, which is really, it's a pasuk in Mishlei, but it's quoted in the Mishnah in Avos, and because what I have here are a couple of sources on Pirkei Avos, I decided to go with the Mishnah, but we'll see the pasuk anyway. So in Pirkei Avos, Perek Dalet Mishnah Yutes, Shmuel HaKatan Omer, Shmuel HaKatan says, and he's really just quoting the pasuk in Mishlei, Bin Fol Oyivcha Al Tismach, very clear, when your enemy falls, don't rejoice. Don't be so happy when somebody you hate and despise and detest, maybe even for all the right reasons, but don't be so overjoyed when he falls. Uvi kashlo al yageli becha. And when he stumbles, don't allow your heart to rejoice and to be so glad. Pen your Hashem, lest Hashem see what you're up to. Verabe enav, and your behavior will now become evil in his eyes. Veheshiv me'alav apo. And now Hashem will remove his anger from upon this person. The sort of like the dot, dot, dot there is that maybe you'll get what's coming to you. Don't put yourself in position where you've now grown so haughty and you think the world of yourself that, Ivan Ligal was coming to him. Maybe Hashem will decide to sort of change his mind and maybe instead cast the evil lot upon he who was previously rejoicing. So that's the Mishnah of this very, very important pasuk in Mishlei. And a couple of interesting comments. So the first comes from Maharal of Prague. Maharal of Prague wrote a commentary on Pirkei Avos called Derech Chaim. And here I skipped around a little bit, but a couple of arrows point to the right way. So the Maharal here is dealing with this general topic of do we or don't we rejoice with the downfall of our enemies? What does it all mean that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was less than pleased and he himself wasn't rejoicing, wouldn't allow Shira to be sung during Kriyas Yamsuf? So how do we put that and piece that all together? Take a look at that first arrow on the right-hand side, the right-hand column. V'hainu taima, so here's the reason. Shevadai ka'asher harish'us nistalek min ha'olam yesh simcha. The Maharal says it depends on what you're talking about. It depends on what you're rejoicing over. Certainly when it comes to the idea of there being that much less rish'us, that much less evil in the world, that is a point of gladness. That's a point of merriment. That's a point of rejoicing. V'zehu mipnei kvod Hashem yisbarach. Why? Because Hashem is in a much better position now than he was previously. It's good for Hashem. It's good for Hashem's PR. It's good for Hashem's image when there's less rishos, because it means that people will appreciate the... And that's true, you can't appreciate light without a little bit of dark, but when there is overwhelming darkness, it's very difficult to appreciate the light and not have all the light just be completely blacked out. So the less of that there is, and the fewer shadows there are, the more the light is able to penetrate, and it's good for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Fikach, therefore, yesh l'smach. We should rejoice over such a thing. Aval HaKadosh Baruch Hu enosas, mipnei desof sof hu kelkala. So it's an interesting thing. He says, at the end of the day, even though it's good and even though it's true, Hashem bemoans the vehicle. Hashem bemoans the approach, the path that was necessary in order to get there. Couldn't it just have been that everybody would have woken up and just have rejoiced in Hashem himself and just have turned themselves on to the beauty and the wisdom that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to offer and the sense of decency and morality that he has to offer and just follow him and be dovek to him? Wouldn't that have been wonderful? And it could have been so. And it didn't end up that way. So we end up in a better position than we were yesterday, but Hashem bemoans the whole thing. Why did it have to come about by means of destruction? Ve'ein simcha l'chol davar shehu kalkala. And there is no such thing as true simcha when the simcha is only arrived at by means of destruction. It's a very, very interesting approach because it sort of parses out that yes, there are things to rejoice over. It's great. It's wonderful that now Klal Yisrael gets sort of a boost. And not for ourselves, and that's important, not just for ourselves, but really because when the entire world is able to look at what's happening to the Jewish people as being proof positive that HaKadosh Baruch Hu not only exists, but that he guides all of human history. How could it be that the Jewish people have survived for so long? Oh my goodness, after all that they've been through and so few in number, and now there's a return to the promised land, and all of these prophecies and all these promises are now made good on. It's a remarkable thing. Mike Pence just said exactly that in Yerushalayim just a little while ago. I saw one comment. It's sad, but you know, never has so much Tanakh been quoted since Menachem Begin was very, very fond of quoting something of Tanakh. Halavai, the prime minister, should be as fluent in Tanakh and be quoting the scriptures as much as the vice president of the United States.
That's why they said that Rabbi Sacks.
Lord
Jonathan Sacks helped write that speech.
Yeah,
good.
I'm just saying. Halavai.
I'm not saying it was he should be on his own.
Halavai, he should be the speechwriter for every prime minister. I would love that. That would be great. He should run for prime minister of his. So, there's a different. I don't want to digress too much, but the idea that somebody who's not from our own, our own member of the tribe, is looking to make those sorts of references, doesn't necessarily speak so glowingly of some of the other material of other speeches that we typically hear from members of Knesset and the like. But at any rate, he's saying exactly that, right? That when these things happen to the Jewish people, it's like something of a wake-up call for everything. Wow, proof positive. Hashem runs the world. And everybody, whatever editorializing anybody else is going to do of that. So that means, proof positive then that the second coming, whatever you want to say. The point is that there is this sense of there being a divine trajectory to all of history. Very, very good. So there is something to rejoice over, but joy is always mitigated when it comes about or when the objective is achieved by means of destruction. It is sad. It is with a tear that's shed when victory comes about at the expense of humanity, at the expense of human life, and all of that. So hence, Hashem's reticence in allowing the Malachim to sing Shira when at the end of the day there are a lot of people who are dying today, and let's sort of have a moment of silence for all of them. Ulfikach malas olam hazeh, and he says, therefore, really, that's why what Hashem really hopes for and the way that this world is supposed to be utilized, shehu tikun l'rishayim, it's supposed to serve as a means of rishayim, anybody, correcting themselves and becoming better. Hashem doesn't want destruction. Hashem doesn't want to wipe people off the map. Hashem, and we should take a note that we should follow suit and recognize that we should all hope that people would just be good and be sweet and be nice and be pleasant and be humane, instead of there being any sort of sense of a need for destruction. If you just jump to the next paragraph, similar idea. And that's what's meant. I made reference to this before. In the first parak of Brachos, Daf Yud Amud Aleph, Rab and Mefaltan Shal Rishon V'Amar Shira, that this is speaking about David HaMelech, who saw the downfall of the Rishon, and he did sing Shira. Shene'amar, Yitamu Chataim Min Haaretz Urshaim Od Einam. We say it in Barchi Nafshi, every Rosh Chodesh, that the Chataim are going to cease and desist, they're going to be done, they're going to be gone from the earth, the Rishayim will be no more, and then he says, Baruch Hinashi Hashem Haleluka. V'davar zeh, midaber b'mefaltan shal Rishayim l'salik harishos min ha'olam. So that's the point that the morale is making. Why is David HaMelech rejoicing? David HaMelech rejoices because there is less rishos in the world. So it's this bifurcation of what it is that we're really singing Shira for, what we're rejoicing over, what we're happy about, and that is a critical lesson that we take into every single scenario in which we actually find history repeating itself. Where there is joy to be had, where there is victory, an important victory, where there's a downfall of our enemies, and our enemies for good reason, on the one hand. So what that means is that we're moving closer to a godly kind of existence here in Olam Hazeh, on the one hand. On the other hand, we bemoan the fact that it had to come at the expense of human life. It would have been so much greater and so much better for everybody if we could have gotten there, if we could have crossed the finish line without there having to be any sort of loss of human life. And that sounds very obvious on paper. The reality is that there is, especially in times of fighting and in times of war and in times of difficulty, and especially when we have been wronged, let's not pretend like the desire and the need and the interest in pure straight up revenge doesn't factor in a little bit. And there isn't something very, very sweet about Osama bin Laden has just been captured. That the hooting and the hollering is not just that this is a safer place now. This is a safer planet. This is a better planet. This is a better place. This is now an environment in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name and interests and desire and will can be better expressed, in which the face of God hasn't been mangled by complete extremism. It's more than that. It's also, you got us, ha, but I knew that we would get you back. And that's not the most healthy thing in the world, it sounds like. Meaning that there should be a certain measure of reminding ourselves, sort of closing our eyes and saying, this is good. It's good for humanity. This is good for the human race. It's good for me and for my neighbors and for world peace and for safety. I wish it didn't have to be this way. I wish it could have come in a different way. And it's a very important sort of philosophy and worldview to take into account when these kinds of things happen. Medrash Shmuel, which is a very interesting commentary on Pirkei Avos. This was written by Shmuel Bar Yitzchak de Ozida. He was a Talmud. He was a Kabbalist and a scholar during sort of the heyday of Tzfat. He was a Talmud of the Arizal, so that whole sort of picture and that whole tekufa of Jewish history. Wrote a number of Svarim. And he brings us even a little bit closer to home. Not just like the Klal Yisrael versus whoever the enemy of Klal Yisrael du jour happens to be, but bringing it very, very close to home. So we might also explain as follows. Delo kashu kra yahadadi, that these two psukim, and he's referring to a number of psukim, but we saw the pasuk at the beginning of Brachos, David HaMelech finally rejoices when he sees Mefat on Shel Rishayim, when he sees the downfall of the enemies, when he sees the downfall of the, ha, you got your comeuppance, HaKadosh Baruch, whose will actually is going to endure, no matter what anybody else may tell you, no matter how delightful things may look in the very narrow moment, over the long course of history, Hashem finally gets his way. On the one hand, on the other hand, bin follow Yivcha al tismach, that we don't rejoice over the downfall of our enemies. What are we supposed to do practically? How do we make sense of these psukim that militate against one another? So he writes, "V'efshar ol lefarish." You could also explain as follows: the lo kashu kraya hadadi, that these psukim really aren't difficult. They don't actually create the sort of refute one another. Afilu im ne'amar shema sha'amar bin follow Yivcha hu afilu yiyah oyev rasha gamur. Truth is, with respect to Binafal Oyivcha, that when your enemy falls, you shouldn't rejoice, even if you would say that he's a Rasha Gamor, even if he's just a despicable, absolutely evil human being. Let's just say that we could, put on our robes and caps, I guess, of judgment, and say, absolutely, there is no excuse, there's no justification, there's no rationalization, he wasn't, patched too hard as a child, or none of that. He's just absolutely thoroughbred wicked. Let's just say, v'inin huzeh. So let's just say that that's the case. Here's really the issue. Kima sha'amar yismach tzadik ube avod risha imrina. What do we mean when we say that a tzadik, that the righteous person should rejoice, that when the evil suffer a downfall, and when they are lost, and when they are wiped off the map, that there should be rina, there should be song? Hakavana, what that means, the intention of those psukim is, she yismach al nikmasan umefaltan shel rishaim, that he should rejoice over the revenge that's taken and the downfall of the enemy, bibchinas hayosam sone Hashem umargize kel, in the sense that they stand against the Kadosh Baruch Hu. I will root for Hashem. Part of rooting for Hashem means rooting against all who stand up against Hashem. Uma sha'amar bin fol oyivcha al tismach. And what do we mean when we say that you shouldn't rejoice? Hakavana bibchinas hayoso oyivcha, oyev lecha umvakesh ra'ascha. The fact that he wanted to do evil to me, this is really, really important. The fact that he wanted to do evil to me, that's what I'm not supposed to rejoice over. Meaning, it's that desire and interest in seeing, this guy who was so nasty to me, and it could be, I mean, nasty is putting it, you know, really, really mildly, if we're speaking about somebody who's who knows, right? Survivor in the colloquial context, or survivor of whatever other sort of abuse and war and strife and difficulty, whatever the case may be. When we speak about Binfol Oyivcha Al Tismach, don't rejoice, it's because it's not supposed to become like my interest is the most important. What's supposed to happen, ideally, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's interest becomes paramount, and that if Hashem's interest is really paramount, then that is my measure of rejoicing. That's my kavana when I actually rejoice. So, v'amar pen yira Hashem v'rabe enav klomar, in other words, ki ulai yira Hashem ki v'simcha zu shesamachta chasta al kvodecha. You don't want Hashem to see, you don't want there to be any sort of suggestion that when I rejoice, it's really because I'm concerned about my own kavana. I'm concerned about my own dignity. I'm concerned more about what happened to me than the general reality of there being evil and there being something terrible in the world. V'lo chasta al dvar kavod shemo, and that he's not more concerned about the kavod of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name. V'lo ze yiyah rabe einav zos ha-simcha. That sort of simcha is going to be ra, is going to be wicked, or is going to be backwards in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'shav me'alav apo nimtza shata ha-sibos, se shalo yinakem davar kavod shemo yisbarach asher chil lo zeharash v'lchein al tismach. Don't rejoice because you don't want to rejoice in a capacity that makes it seem like the standing up against the Kaddish Baruch Hu is somehow or another playing second fiddle. That doesn't mean that when we've been wronged, that there is no measure for joy when the person who wronged us sort of gets what's coming to him. It's just that it's not really about us. It's that what happened to me becomes a microcosm of all the rest of the world. And it's much better off to live in a world in which evil just doesn't exist. I can tolerate evil that's happening to me, meaning I can tolerate whatever discomfort may have come my way. Part of this is also wrapped up in the whole bitachon of if Hashem did it, then must be, somehow or another, there's a plan, etc., etc. But that with respect to whatever difficulty and whatever hardship and whatever suffering this person may have put me through, so that's me. That's my own peckle, that's my own issue. But the joy that I experience with his downfall is the fact that whatever he perpetrated against me is wrong, is evil. I don't want that evil to exist. I don't want that wrong to be here. Not just because it stood against my comfort or militated against my comfort, but that inherently and fundamentally it just shouldn't be there. We're not furthering the entire objective and the entire aim of all of history and all of humanity the longer such a person is able to continue to perpetrate those kinds of crimes. So very similar kind of approach to the Maharal, at least insofar as, yes, there's a different way of looking at it. It depends on what your attitude is and what your mentality is. But it's a little bit closer to home in terms of saying, or almost questioning, when we rejoice, why are we doing it? Is it because I had this very deep sort of sense and deep desire and deep passion for revenge, and now I finally was able to make good on that, or was able to at least witness that, at least able to view that? Or is it that I can't tolerate the idea that this evil exists at all in the world because I'm so bound up in what Hashem's will is for the direction in which the world is ultimately going? So a number of different perspectives on what exactly it means. It is very, very clear that there is some sort of tension here. That it's not an absolute yes or a no. It's not an absolute yes, let's all rejoice. It's not an absolute no, shame on us, we shouldn't. It's more, at least according to these couple of sources that we brought, more a question of questioning. It's more a question of trying to analyze and trying to wonder, why is it that we're doing it? What motivates our simcha? And trying to call into question how much is appropriate and how much perhaps still continues to or needs to be worked on. With that, I'd like to turn our attention. Let's do one last piece for Parshas Yisro, and let's actually open up to the beginning of Parshas Yisro. Just have a little bit of a sense of the psukim. Very, very interesting Abarbanel. In general, just a brief word on the Abarbanel. What's very typical for the Abarbanel is that it'll ask really a whole series of questions. It's not like a Rashi, like a Ramban, like a Sforno. It's not like Mikros Gedolos, like a tight and terse kind of vart on whatever is happening on that given pasuk. It's more, I have 1,001 questions. There's so much that doesn't make sense to me here. And then he'll go on with a much more protracted kind of essay-length approach to the entire parsha that systematically answers all of those questions that he brought initially. So we're sort of taking something of a cross-sampling, cross-section of a piece of the beginning of Parshas Yisro from the Abarbanel and really jumping into what is the fifth of five questions that he asks. But first, let's take a look at the Psukim themselves, the beginning of Parshas Yisro. So it's on page 398 in the stone. A couple of different Psukim here. Let's take a look at Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayomer Chosein Moshe Elav. So Moshe's father-in-law said to him, Lo tov adavar asher ata oseh. The thing that you're doing, it's no good. It's no good. What's he referring to? What was Yisro's big critique of Moshe Rabbeinu and the way that Moshe Rabbeinu was running? What was the
answering
everything. He's answering all the shilas, right? He has to learn. They teach you that now. They teach you this in rabbi school. These are the text messages you should avoid, and these are the ones you should respond to. These are the chas v'shalom. Now it's more out of a sense of either laziness or overwhelm. That's the word I was looking for. But forget about being overwhelmed. If you're Moshe Rabbeinu, he is there dusk till dawn, answering every, and then back again, answering every single question. How could it be? How could Moshe Rabbeinu answer every single question that arose? So what does Yisro say? Navol tibol gam ata. You will be completely worn out. Gam ha'am hazeh asher imach. So will this nation that you're trying to lead. Ki chaved mimcha davar. It's too much for you. It's too great for you. It's too difficult. It's too heavy a burden. Lo suchal azo levadecha. You're not able to do it all on your own. It's impossible. There's no way that you can do this. How are you supposed to answer every single question? So what Yisro basically introduces Moshe Rabbeinu to, we have a word for it, it's called bureaucracy, which is usually viewed in a very, very pejorative context. I don't know that we ever use the word bureaucracy in glowing, like very fair. Oh, it's so wonderful to have such bureaucracy. All this red tape that you have to cut through in order to be able to get anything done. Isn't it marvelous? You know, staying at the DMV for 14 hours on end to renew your driver's license. But Yisro's point is that has a place and that has a purpose, and you're going to wear yourself out. So what does he recommend? He recommends creating this hierarchy, creating a bureaucracy, whereby not every single question can go straight to the top. If you jump down a little bit, here's who he introduces Moshe Rabbeinu to, or here's who he suggests that Moshe Rabbeinu should seek out. Ve'ata, if you go down to Pasuk Chafala, ve'ata sechazeh, and you should seek mikol ha'am, from the entire nation, anshe chayil, men of valor, yirei Elokim, who fear God, anshe emes, men of truth, sone vatsa, and who despise reward, who detest bribe and being compensated for their efforts. I don't want to really, this is going to be a little bit of a spoiler alert, I don't really want to take away from still the Abarbanel's thunder here. If you were to suggest that there should be, that we should look to a given group of people in order to become Dayanim over all of Klal Yisrael, if you had to think of one, less than that, if you had to think of two, I think I see where this is going, if you had to think of like a couple of midos, or a couple of criteria that would be necessary, a couple of qualities, what would you say?
Knowledgeable.
So I thought, okay, the reason why I said two is because I thought maybe first we would say honest, okay, very good, yes, he should be honest, and he sort of covers honesty, so ne'evatza, meaning they should have no want or no need for compensation, therefore they can't be bribed. Fine. Knowledgeable. Knowledgeable doesn't make the list. It's very interesting. Knowledgeable is not on this list. They shouldn't be easily swayed. They should be men of truth. They should be men of valor. They should have fear of God. But how about known Shulchan Aruch, like the back of your hand? How about knowledgeable? Very, very interesting. Enter the Abarbanel. Should be noted that part of what the Abarbanel is really addressing here is the point at which Yisro comes, which is a major fight amongst the Mefarshim. When is it that Yisro actually approaches Moshe? Is this out of order? Does Yisro actually come following Har Sinai, which hasn't really happened yet? Or does he come before Har Sinai, which is where we actually find it placed in the Chumash? So, a whole to-do. The Abarbanel, I think we're going to see this... he's going to just sort of give it as a throwaway. He develops this idea much, much, much further, a whole number of different psukim that he brings as proofs. But the Abarbanel takes the approach that what you see is what you get. Yisrael comes before Har Sinai because that's the way that the Parsha actually unfolds, and he takes that at face value for a whole number of reasons. Not nearly as simple as that, but he believes that Yisrael comes before Har Sinai. That's an important point. Fine. Hasheela Hahei. Here is Hachamishi. Here is the fifth question that the Abarbanel asks. Ba'atzas Yisrael Moshe, b'minui ha-shoftim, when Yisrael gives the advice that he should appoint all these judges, kihine divrei Yisrael hayutovim menuchochim, they're very good, tried and true, makes a lot of good sense, aval kal shebekalim, it's the most obvious thing in the world, yavin v'yeda shahaysa etza nivara lamod adam echad min haboker ad ha'erev lishpot. Of course it doesn't make any sense to have one person, the same guy, listening to all the complaints. He is the judge, jury, and executioner for everything, from every degree of court. He's the Supreme Court, and he's Judge Judy, and everything in between. Kibazen navol yivol. He's going to surely wear himself out. And he's going to become become broken, and he's going to start making errors. How could it be that they didn't realize this? Moshe Rabbeinu didn't notice this. None of the others at Canaan recognized this. How do they not get that if you appoint more judges, it'll make the whole process not just easier, not just like Moshe Rabbeinu, you can go on vacation for a while, take the wife and kids to Hawaii for a couple of weeks, but that the system would make more sense, it would work better, it would be better for everybody. How did they not realize this? So the Abarbanel now takes shots. Uchvar Rabbim dibru al zem me'od keneged adon hanavim. There are many who explain this basically by throwing Moshe Rabbeinu under the bus, by speaking against the adon hanavim. It's not necessarily such a, I don't have to go to bat for everybody else, but the Abarbanel takes the suggestion that it just didn't occur to Moshe Rabbeinu as being highly insulting and highly inappropriate, to say the least. Shahaya chaser b'hanhaga hamedinis, because Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest Navi in the world, but he wasn't like amongst the people, and he didn't see what was going on, and the idea of like political systems was sort of beyond him. He was, in a very positive, very wonderful way, he was aloof. He wasn't hip to all of that because he was busy speaking directly to HaKadosh Baruch Hu panim el panim. So there are certain things that very good. So he has somebody like Yisro whisper something in his ear, and then it's ratified by Moshe Rabbeinu. He loves the idea, and they roll with it. Because he was always on his own, and he was always alone, and he was floating around in the spiritual stratosphere. So these things just didn't occur to him. Sheker. It's all false. Abarbanel just doesn't like it. Kishlemus midosav yoru al chachmasa behem, because the completion of the midos that Moshe Rabbeinu achieved, it just makes this all impossible. Vashem yisbarach ichlo lamdu da'as usvuna kala kazos. How could it be that Hashem didn't whisper this into his ear? Why should it be that he has to wait for Yisrael? If this is really what's best for Klal Yisrael, and this is important policy for all Klal Yisrael, how does it happen that it comes from Yisro instead of a directive from a Kaddish Baruch Hu? Fine. Abarbanel's question is, why didn't Moshe Rabbeinu think of that himself? So why do we need Yisro? Va'omer. So here's his answer. This is skipping a whole lot, but va'omer. Ki bihios shi Yisro ba kodem matan Torah. Because, as I've already proven, Yisro came before matan Torah. Haya yoshev Moshe lishpot es ha'am. Moshe Rabbeinu was sitting and judging the entire nation. Min haboker ad ha'ere, from morning until night. V'lo haya mimena anashim acherim l'shoftam. There wasn't anybody else who was up to the task. L'fi shadayin lo nasan lahem Torah v'nimus shi yishpetu bo. Because there was not yet any body of knowledge and any body of ethics, any code, any protocol to be able to judge them by. Kimash anitin b'mara, it's true that there were a certain number of mitzvahs that were already given at Mara, at an earlier point before reaching Har Sinai, but that was me'ikri hadinim l'moshe ifkod. Those things were really just basically basic like titles and headers of all of the different mitzvos, those were given to Moshe Rabbeinu. V'adayin lo tzivau Hashem sheiten hadinin ha'heim li Yisrael ad parshas ve'elam mishpatim k'mo shebiarti. As I've already explained, and I'll go on to explain, it talks about in parshas mishpatim, that it wasn't until parshas mishpatim that everybody else becomes privy to this. Nobody else knows Torah doesn't exist for anybody yet other than Moshe Rabbeinu. U'mipnei zeh hutrach Moshe Rabbeinu b'tchilas inyano lishpot es ha'am ba'atzmo. Had to do it all by himself. L'visha adam ayin sheyeda ikrei hadin en ha'elokiyim ladun bahem adayin. Nobody yet knew any of the divine mitzvos and the divine wisdom to be able to actually judge people accordingly. V'gam lo ratza sheyishpitu es ha'am shoftegem ba'omir hadas usvar. And the last thing Moshe Rabbeinu wanted is to appoint a bunch of judges who would have said, well, this seems reasonable, this seems okay, I'm a man of wisdom and of truth, and I'm God-fearing. The last thing in the world Moshe Rabbeinu wants is for that kind of person to be in place, to just sort of have a sense based on his own inner moral compass. Because in just a few days, Yekablu es haTorah, they are going to receive the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu is aware of that. K'moshe ye'ado ha'yizbarach, just as HaKadosh Baruch Hu had informed him of. Botziacha es ha'am Mitzrayim, when you take the nation out of Mitzrayim, tavdun es ha'elokim al ha'har hazeh. This is back in Parsha Shmos, at the burning bush. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him, when you take them out, they're going to come and receive the Torah right here. So Moshe Rabbeinu knows that already. V'tzivo yisbarach ha-mishpatim asher yasim lefnehem. And he already gave the mishpatim by which Moshe Rabbeinu should judge them. Hayadaito sha'az achrei kiblu ha-Torah v'ha-mishpatim bihyos lefnehem seder v'nimus ha-mishpatim k'sholchan arach. That once they get to the point, which will be in just a few days, that they'll have the entire thing open in front of them like a set table, like a Shulchan Aruch. Yimanez ha-shoftim lishpot osam lo ba'omer usvara. So now I can appoint judges because they're not going to go about judging them just by means of estimation and svara and logic and whatever occurs to them. Ela al pi hachok v'amishpatim sheyasim lefnei me'es Hashem. In a few days they'll get the Torah. So let's already appoint them. Let's put them in place so that when the Torah comes, they'll be able to turn around and start issuing judgments. Aval Yisro lo hayodea mizeh, davar. Yisro didn't know this at all. He had no idea. Yisro didn't know that there's this whole body of law that they're going to be held accountable for and that they're going to have to be judged up against. V'chashav, what did he think? Shemasha hayaosa Moshe litzorech sha'a, that what Moshe Rabbeinu was only doing for the moment, for that particular time, Yisro thought, ken yatamid, it'll always be that way. It's going to be that way forever and ever, in perpetuity. And that's dangerous as anything. Can't go on like this, is Yisro. So that's why he grabbed hold of Moshe regarding this issue. And he said to him, Navolti boy, you're going to wear yourself out. So what he suggested was instead appoint judges. Yisro has no idea that the Torah is coming. Yisro has no idea that there are four chalakim of Shulchan Aruch that are going to be important for every dayan to know to be able to make any of these judgments. He has no idea. He sees Moshe Rabbeinu doing his best. So he says, appoint some other people who also do their best. Granted, make sure that they're good people, make sure that they're Yarei Hashem, make sure that they're God-fearing, make sure that they're just, that they're upright, that they're moral, that they're ethical, but get some help. So he says, why is it that it occurred to Yisro specifically, you know, to just have other people who will, you know, try to do their best based on sort of intuition, moral intuition? Kasher hayunoagim b'midyan, just as they were doing in Midyan, where Yisro was the Kohen, where Yisro was appointed as an important person. V'gam hayom, and even today, nohagim kein b'chol ratzos yishma'elim. It goes on today in the Arabic land, says the Abarbanel, that people are judging not necessarily based on a corpus of law as much as moral intuition. V'lazer tzivosh yivchar anshei chayil yirei elokim anshei emes son e'batza v'lo amar sheyeyu chachamim. What does Yisro leave off the list? Knowledgeable. They should be Anshei Emes, they should be Sonei Batza, but they don't need to be knowledgeable, because knowledgeable of what? What do they need to be knowledgeable of? Yisro never mentions, oh, and by the way, make sure that they are Talmidei Chachamim, because there's no such concept and construct yet as being a Talmud Chacham. Moshe Rabbeinu knows that it's right around the corner, it's coming down the pike, but Yisro has no idea. So Yisro is making a very appropriate, innocent, if a bit naive perhaps, or at least less than clairvoyant, statement or giving that sort of advice to Moshe Rabbeinu, with regards to who he should appoint. He should appoint people that are good people. Moshe Rabbeinu recognizes that you can't. You need very specific people, people who will be knowledgeable in Torah to be able to take care of the judgment. So he didn't realize that there would be such a notion as a Torah that we would then get our hands on. Moshe Rabbeinu Lashon. Here's really the case. So it's very interesting. It's just so interesting to be able to read that into the Pesukim. Very, very clever. Fascinating and amazing deal that he makes in the advice that's given by Yisro to Moshe Rabbeinu. He says nothing about being knowledgeable. What's going on? Now you know what's going on. It makes all the sense in the world. Very, very clever and very, very beautiful. Yeah?
Isn't the question just glare that... Isn't it a glaring question that... Like, he didn't see what Moshe was answering to understand that you had to have some knowledge? Like, what did he think Moshe was answering?
So I don't know that if Moshe Rabbeinu was...
After this,
I mean, there are a few things. It's hard to, put ourselves exactly back in the time and place in real time. I don't know that Yisro was literally sitting next to Moshe Rabbeinu as he's delivering verdicts. And if it's really the case that Moshe Rabbeinu is delivering a verdict to a populace that is similarly unaware of Halacha and Torah, because it doesn't exist yet, so it's not so much that Moshe Rabbeinu would be telling them, oh yeah, you actually owe him the money, because it's a Beferisha Ramah. I mean, you're Ashkenazi, so you have to pay him the money, because if you were Sephardi, then the Mechaber holds in that same sif. And if you take a look at the Shach also brings... Like, there's none of that.
It
might just be...
You can ask in hindsight.
Right, it might just be like a very decisive, yeah, you should pay him up. Right, yeah, you can't open up your business there. You can't sell... You can't be selling, shawarma down the street from... Yankel, who's also selling shawarma in the next tent over. It's not fair. Now, why? Because there's this din, and because it's a sagas gvul, and because this and the other thing. So there might just not be any of that, even in the actual verdict, such that Yisro has any idea. Yisro sees somebody who's honest, a man of integrity, his son-in-law, who he loves dearly, who's, doing his best. He doesn't realize necessarily how much there really is behind it. To me, this is the kicker. The coup de grace is really what this means in the mind of Moshe Rabbeinu. So what is Moshe Rabbeinu? Why does it take an Abarbanel to... If this is all true, right? Granted, Shivim Panim LaTorah, not everybody agrees. If it's all true, why do I need the Abarbanel to finally break this whole thing wide open and let the cat out of the bag and spill the beans that this is what was taking place? The Moshe Rabbeinu really knew that the whole time. You really had it there. You needed to know that. And instead of Yisro, you're totally off the wall. You're totally off the wall. You have no idea what's going on here. And I'm going to tell you that you have no idea what's going on here. Fine, we'll do. We'll go ahead. But only because of this close to us. Why don't we know any of this? Why isn't there some conversation between Moshe Rabbeinu and Yisro about, Abba, Dad, Shver, with all due respect... There's a whole system at place here, and you have to appreciate what's going on. And very politely and very nicely, why isn't there any of that? So here's the best. Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Hashalom, kedei l'chabed es chosno, in order to honor his father-in-law. V'liosod Hashem li'reyav. There's this other general idea that when a Kadosh Baruch Hu speaks a nevuah to a navi, two kinds of nevuah. There's a nevuah that is meant to immediately be shared with Klal Yisrael, and there's more of a nevuah that puts the Navi himself on a given trajectory to ensure that such and such actually take place at some point, but not necessarily that it's to be shared with the rest of the population. So Lo Yigidlo, he never tells him. Lo Yigidlo Inyan Hatar, he never tells him about it. Shahayu Asidim Lakab of Lo, Hisvakech Imo Amin Hagu. Can you imagine what a fool Moshe Rabbeinu feels like he must look like to his father-in-law? Sweetie, Shefala, listen, I love you. I'm so happy that you're part of the family now. You're going to wear yourself out. There's this thing, if you weren't so completely narrow-minded and were a little bit more broad and Chachamein of Barosha could see what's going on in the world around you, then you would know that there is such a thing as bureaucracy and as policies and protocols and a hierarchy, and you could be like a member of the Supreme Court, you could have other people working under you. There's a concept called delegating. What kind of a fool does Moshe Rabbeinu feel like he looks like in front of his father-in-law? And mum's the word. What does he do? He says, oh, that's a brilliant idea. Because right now all the stars are in alignment anyway. Right now, Yisro, my grandmother always used to say, right, even a stopped clock is right twice a day. Right? Yisro is absolutely right for all the wrong reasons. The time is ripe to appoint people, but not because it's time, because we may as well get other people who are similarly qualified in terms of morality, ethics, decency, Yiras Shamayim, etc., etc. The reason why you're right is because now we're about to get the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't say anything. Why? Because why bother? Because who cares? Because what difference does it make? Why does Moshe Rabbeinu need to be dismissive or need to put his own father-in-law in his place with respect to the advice that he's giving, just so that he can feel like, please, are you kidding me? Like, I thought of this a month ago. I thought of this 2 months ago. It doesn't make sense. Do me a favor. Why don't you go back to Midian, where you're deemed be as being very, very important. I'm sure they respect you very, very much. I got this. Don't worry. Goel, you know, Rabban Shel Yisrael, like it's all okay. I can figure this out all on my own. Mum's the word. Because why bother? Why bother sharing anything? Moshe Rabbeinu is able to recognize that what matters here is not so much how his father-in-law or anybody else views him. It's not that this, what is going to be perceived as this brilliant, golden idea that is about to be rolled out onto all of Klal Yisrael, he doesn't need it to come from him. What difference does it make? If it's right, it's right. If it's not right, it's not right. It happens to be right now. Not because Yisro's thinking, not because of his perspective, not because of the way he was looking at it, but it happens to be right now. So let him be right. So who cares? So who cares? I have to like stand on ceremony and insist, I want you to know I'm doing this, but I'm doing this for a different reason. It's not because of what you said. It's really for a whole different thought process that has nothing to do with you. You should know that I thought of this ages ago. It's a really beautiful, really, really beautiful idea. And I think it ties in so nicely, actually, with the first concept that we were talking about. A little bit of perspective, that in removing ourselves from the scenario, removing ourselves from whatever scene we're actually playing out and playing through, getting a little bit of perspective about what the most important thing is. Is it good for Hashem or is it not good for Hashem? If it's bad for Hashem because this human being or group of human beings were perpetrating the kinds of crimes that remove Kvod Shamayim, so then it's good for Hashem if they be removed. So good. So that's something that we can rejoice over. I don't need to rejoice over the fact that now the person who be'aveled me got his comeuppance. Nor do I need to make sure that when I'm right, that I don't allow somebody else to be able to get the credit for it. That if an idea is going to be unveiled as this beautiful, marvelous kind of new system that's going to change everybody's life for the better, that I necessarily need to be the one who gets the ticker tape parade and gets all the cheers and all the applause. So Moshe Rabbeinu is very much a role model, not surprisingly, in that capacity. And I think sort of the general theme of all of it is try whenever we possibly can to remove ourselves from the situation, consider what's really important more globally on a more macro level of Kvod Shamayim, whether our activities, other people's activities, is bringing Kvod Shamayim to a new plateau or Chas V'Shalom, the opposite. Shkayach, thanks for joining everybody. We'll meet again in a couple of weeks. All the best.
That was amazing.
I'm glad.